This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Tuesday Ukraine had proven once again it was able to take the initiative as it presses its unprecedented military incursion into Russia's Kursk region. In his nightly address to the nation, President Zelensky said, "We have once again proven that in any situation, we Ukrainians are able to achieve our goals. We are able to protect our interests and our independence." Ukraine blindsided Moscow by pouring thousands of troops into Kursk last week in a surprise operation that has given Ukraine its biggest battlefield gains since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. U.S. President Joe Biden made his first public comments Tuesday about the Ukrainian incursion.
"I have spoken with my staff on a regular basis, probably every 4 or 5 hours for the last 6 or 8 days, and it's creating a real dilemma for Putin, and we've been in direct contact, constant contact with the Ukrainians."
The U.S. has provided billions of dollars of weaponry to Ukraine since 2022, intended largely for defensive purposes. Cracks are widening in a public dispute between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his defense minister. AP correspondent Julia Franco said Tuesday the latest spat shows growing discontent with Netanyahu's handling of the war at a sensitive time.
People are here bracing for a potential retaliatory strike by Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon for the assassination of top Hamas and Hezbollah leaders. And the rift also comes as talks are set to convene on Thursday for another attempt to broker a ceasefire.
That was AP correspondent Julia Franco. International Edition delivers insight into world news through eyewitnesses, correspondent reports, and analysis from experts and newsmakers. This is VOA News. A U.S. State Department official said Tuesday Qatar will seek to convince Hamas to participate in Thursday's peace talks over the war in Gaza. Hamas has so far declined to agree to take part in negotiations, which take place amid fears that tensions between Israel and Iran could escalate following Israel's killing of Hamas political chief Ismail Haniyeh. U.S. State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel said American efforts are focused on preventing greater violence and ending humanitarian suffering in the region. Firefighters in Greece on Tuesday continued their efforts to bring the massive wildfires raging across the northern suburbs of Athens under control. The fires triggered massive evacuations and left at least one person dead. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
In Anorpatima, a northern suburb of Athens, emergency workers began cutting burnt trees as part of a cleanup operation. Fire authorities said the wildfire had scattered from one single big blaze to many active localized blazes. Fire crews worked frantically to take advantage of a drop in winds to extinguish the fires before the wind was expected to pick up. Greek firefighters are expected to be boosted by forces from other countries after Athens sought international assistance, activating Europe's mutual civil protection mechanism. I'm Karen Chamas.
A Ugandan court on Tuesday found Thomas Kwayelo, a commander in the Rebel Lords of Resistance Army, guilty of dozens of war crimes. Kwayelo is the first senior member of the group to have been tried by Uganda's judiciary. Founded in the late 1980s with the aim of overthrowing the government, the LRA terrorized Ugandans under the leadership of Joseph Kony for nearly 20 years as it battled the military from bases in northern Uganda. The LRA was notorious for its horrific brutality, including rapes, abductions, and deadly beatings. Africa's top public health agency on Tuesday declared an mpox emergency as a new variant moves across the Democratic Republic of Congo. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan reports.
The African Center for Disease Control and Prevention said the viral infection was spreading at an alarming rate. Mpox is transmitted through close contact and causes flu-like symptoms and pus-filled lesions. The new variant of an endemic strain of the virus appears to spread more easily through close contact, particularly among children. Mpox has been endemic in parts of Africa for decades after it was first detected in humans in 1970. A milder version spread to over 100 countries in 2022.
That was Reuters correspondent Seth Hogan. For more on this and all the stories we're covering, visit us at voanews.com. And also, remember to download our app. Just search for VOA News. I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sierra Leone's president reiterates Africa's demands for a permanent seat on the UN Security Council.
The current lack of representation in the permanent category does not reflect the current global landscape. Africa demands equitable representation in all UN decision-making organs.
An analyst agrees but wants to know whether a seat for Africa would have veto power. Guinea's capital was quiet on Tuesday following Monday's sit-down strike for democracy. Turkey holds a second round of talks between Ethiopia and Somalia to resolve a dispute over Ethiopia's port deal with Somaliland. A Ugandan court finds former LRA commander guilty for war crimes.
I'm happy today. The victims, they will sleep because the judgment, at least it is there. There's some progress.
And Vice President Kamala Harris faces misogyny and racism in her bid for the White House. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. This week, Sierra Leone President Julius Maada Bio reiterated Africa's long-standing demand for more representation on the UN Security Council, including two permanent seats with veto power. He spoke on behalf of an African Union committee of 10 heads of state and government on reform of the UN Security Council.
After nearly 80 years since the establishment of the United Nations and its Security Council, its imbalanced structure of bygone eras persist, undermining the legitimacy and effectiveness. It is therefore fundamentally important to address the issue of non-representation and underrepresentation of Africa in both the permanent and non-permanent categories of the Security Council, respectively. The current lack of representation in the permanent category does not reflect the current global landscape, and it is fundamental to consider the structural changes for its rectification. Africa demands equitable representation in all UN decision-making organs, particularly the Security Council. By ensuring Africa's voice is heard, we can legitimize the UN's work and truly implement decisions that benefit the continent. Considering this unfairness, we marginalize an entire continent that is highly important on the Security Council's agenda. Africa boasts a population of over 1.3 billion people, and its 54 countries represent about 28% of the total UN membership. Africa plays a significant role in peacekeeping and conflict resolution, yet it is vastly underrepresented. Therefore, our demand for two permanent seats with all the rights and prerogatives of current members and two additional non-permanent member seats is a matter of common justice that needs to be addressed.
Sierra Leone President Julius Maada Bio speaking Monday at the United Nations. A political analyst says Africa's demand for a permanent seat on the UN Security Council is significant because Africa is a very important continent. However, Kweku Nuama, a professor in the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C., tells me that a seat on the council without veto power will be the same as Africa's representation in the General Assembly.
Well, I think it's a reasonable demand considering the fact that a third of the UN's member states are African and about 50% of current peacekeeping missions are in Africa. Africa is very important to the United Nations and that relationship will continue to grow. So it's a fair demand to make. Unfortunately, I don't think that it's going to matter much because the type of representation that you have matters. So if Africa gets a lot more representation in the Security Council, but it doesn't come with a veto power, it really doesn't change much. Then we get back to the General Assembly where you have a lot of votes, but you really don't have any power. So the type of representation that Africa gets matters. But this is it's a good demand to make, and I think that there's general goodwill towards that. The United States appears to be interested in supporting that demand. The Chinese will probably go out ahead with it. I don't think that it will lead to a permanent seat or a veto power.
The United Nations will meet soon, next month, I think September. What does Africa need to do?
Well, Africa needs to make their demands, and it needs to submit a proposal. The current African proposal is to get 5 more seats, and they want 2 permanent seats. But as I said, you can get a permanent seat. The question is whether they come with veto, or if you're not going to get a veto, can you get the organization to scrap the veto power altogether? And I don't think that that's going to be possible. The way the UN works, they're going to probably set up some committee to study this matter again. Nothing will really come out of it. The UN has changed over time, so change is not impossible. Remember, we started off with 6 non-permanent seats, and now we have 10 in there. 2 of the current permanent members were not even members of the organization that is founded. I mean, the Chinese replaced Taiwan in 1971, and Russia replaced the Soviet Union in 1991. So change is possible. The problem now is that the countries that have the veto power do not want to dilute that power. So they can allow their allies in, they can allow other countries to come in. But the question is, are you sitting at a table as an equal, or are you sitting at a table in a lesser capacity where you don't really have the power to either direct what the organization does?
So, Professor, if I hear you clearly, it's a matter of power play by the superpowers at the Security Council.
It's always been about power play. And whilst one power may like this African demand, another power may oppose it. Now, if you look at the main powers that are actually driving the organization, Africa has pretty good relationships with Russia, pretty good relationship with China, and the United States as well. But once you have that power, the question is, how are you going to vote in the council? And we're not even sure. Africans have not even agreed on how this permanent seat that we are demanding is going to be distributed. Is it going to be something that is held by the African Union, or are we going to have African countries fight over it? And if so, which country is going to have that power?
Kweku Nuama is a professor in the School of International Service at American University here in Washington, D.C. This week, Turkey hosted its second round of talks between East African neighbors, Ethiopia and Somalia, to try to resolve a dispute over Addis Ababa's deal with the breakaway region of Somaliland. Tension between the two countries have simmered since Ethiopia signed a memorandum of understanding with Somaliland in January, which Somalia denounced as infringing upon its sovereignty and territorial integrity. Abdi Ismail Samatar is a professor at the University of Minnesota and is senator in the Somali parliament. He tells viewers Douglas Mpuga that he doesn't expect much from the talks.
I have absolutely zero expectations because of the mismatch between the rhetoric and the reality in the case of Ethiopia. The prime minister says that Ethiopia respects the territorial integrity and unity of Somalia, but on the other hand, is negotiating with rebellious groups from part of the country. The Somali government hasn't done a lot of its homework to make sure that it brings its own people together as a union. And so that mismatch creates sort of what I call the dialogue of the death. Ethiopia is hungry for sea, regardless of the ways in which Uganda or Zambia or Botswana works through other countries' ports without claiming territories in those countries. And Somalia is just too weak and corrupt to be unable to bring its people together such that they can defend their territory while at the same time working with neighbors in ways that are mutually beneficial without claiming the territories of others. That's what's going on, and that's why these talks will not go anywhere unless there's a sobering effect on the part of both countries.
What do you make of Turkey's role, given Turkey's recent interest in Africa?
Well, the Turkish government, particularly since Erdogan came to power nearly almost 20 years ago, has reimagined Turkey's role in the globe and certainly sees Africa, much like China sees Africa, as a place where it can make money, can gain resources, and maybe in the process leave something good for the Africans behind. But it's for the Africans to be able to negotiate hard and to prioritize developments and productivity and employment in the continent itself. And so Turkey uses these experiences, these examples, the case of negotiations between Somalia and Ethiopia and a few other places, as a way to impress Africans that Turkey is on the African side. Whether that will actually materialize or not in reality in our continent is a different story.
And what became of African solutions to African problems?
The trouble is that I have never believed that to be the case with the elites that exist in Africa. You know, I'm a member of the Pan-African Parliament also, and I have seen things from that vantage point. Our countries have become isolated boxes in a territory called Africa. The elites in our continent have the rhetoric and the platitudes of African unity, but the substance of their work, both in the local countries where they dominate and in the broader continent, is a farce, in my opinion. And so the day African elites begin to become like the Chinese elites or the European elites, where their center of gravity is the development of their continent and their countries jointly and comparatively, then at that day will be the dawn of African solutions for African problems.
Abdi Ismail Samata is a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali Parliament. He spoke from Minneapolis, Minnesota, with viewers Douglas Umpuga. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 14th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A Ugandan court has found former Lord's Resistance Army commander Thomas Kuyelo guilty of 44 out of 78 war crimes charges brought against him. Halima Atumani reports from Gulu, Uganda, where many of the rebel group's victims welcomed the verdict.
Dressed in a black suit and maroon tie, Thomas Kuyelo, sitting under time, standing tensely, looked on as the verdict was announced in his trial, which began in 2019. Four judges outlined the court decision late Tuesday afternoon, with Justice Mike Elubu reading each of the 78 counts. Many victims followed the proceedings in the northern town of Gulu. The LRA was founded by Joseph Kony, who led a rebellion from 1986 to 2005 against President Yoweri Museveni's government. The group was accused of carrying out multiple massacres. Kony is still at large. Kuyelo, now 50, was captured in 2009 in the Democratic Republic of Congo and has been in detention since. The charges against him included murder, kidnap with intent to murder, pillaging, cruel treatment, torture, rape, and crimes against humanity.
He's found guilty on 44 of the counts.
Stella Angel Anam is founder of the War Victims and Children Networking Initiative. She listened closely as the judge read the offences Kuyelo was convicted of, including those of forced child marriages and forceful sexual intercourse. She knows these offences personally. At the age of 10, Lanam was abducted by the LRA and held captive for 9 years. She was forced to marry a then 38-year-old Lord's Resistance Army commander. She had a child at the age of 13 and suffered a pregnancy complication known as a uterine inversion. After the verdict, Lanam, now 38, says it was a good start.
This court has taken a long time. I'm happy today. The victims today will sleep because the judgment, at least it is there. This is some progress.
Lenam returned in 2006 at a time most rebels decided to take up the amnesty offer that started in 2000. She says she was shocked that her own family and community rejected her and her child because the baby was fathered by a rebel. Lanam says she and other women in similar circumstances have a simple request.
How can you be with a person who still have traumatized?
Between government of the Uganda and the LRA, they should give justice to the victims.
Paul Ogena lost 8 family members in the insurgency led by the LRA. He says the LRA left his home devastated as they took his parents, whose remains have never been found.
If we could get their remains and make a decent burial, it would be even far better. But the person who did it should get a fair judgment, which fair judgment we have already had today.
Kuoyelo's sentencing date has not yet been set. Halima Athmani for VA News, Gulu, Uganda.
Guinea's capital, Conakry, was said to be quiet on Tuesday following Monday's sit-down strike to pressure the military junta to honor its promise of returning the country to democratic rule by the end of the year. Meanwhile, Reuters reported Monday that Guinea's National Transition Council had published online the country's draft constitution. Reporter Karim Kamara in Conakry tells me there are concerns. The new constitution leaves room for junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya to run for president.
Before being published online, the new constitution was first presented to members of the National Transitional Council, which is a proxy of a national assembly, and to ambassadors and heads of national institutions. The new constitution will be voted in a referendum at the end of this year. In the new constitution, presidential mandate is limited to only 2 terms, 5 years each. An age limit ranges from 35 to 80 years. And for the first time in the Guinean constitution, there is a mention of an independent candidacy. This makes this constitution a different one.
Will junta leader General Mamadi Doumbouya run for the presidency? That's the big question.
Since the new constitution provided for an independent candidacy, there is speculation that junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya might stand for presidency, and during a press conference here, the chairperson of the National Transitional Council, Dr. Dansa Koroma, made it clear that the article for independent candidacy that will not be eliminated, and it will serve anybody who wants to can at least stand in any electoral post or any elective post in this country.
We understand that there were 2 mass movements in Guinea on Monday. Tell us first about the strike action called by the opposition.
Yes, Monday's sit-down strike action was called by the opposition to show their disapproval of that article that says an independent candidacy is now allowed in Guinea. And they say that article was just created in the constitution as a ploy to create a way for junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya to stand in the upcoming presidential elections. They say, but no matter how, they will do everything to hinder Mamadi Doumbouya and his cohort from taking part in any future elections in this country. They say Monday's sit-down strike action was just a beginning of series of other demonstrations they are planning to hold in this country to make sure that no member of the junta that will stand in the upcoming elections. Earlier, Mamadi Doumbouya told ECOWAS that neither he nor member of the military junta will stand in any future elections in this country. Now, Mamadi has returned from Rwanda on Monday, and he was welcomed at the Ahmed Sekou-Touré airport here in Conakry by thousands of his supporters. They landed straight over the airport and also accompanied junta leader in all kind of jubilations, and they were fanfare. That we are all dancing, shouting on board, and the vehicles on board, what a vans and all the rest, until they accompanied junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya to his residence.
That's reporter Karim Kamara speaking with us from the Guinean capital, Conakry. Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, said Tuesday that several of its top leaders had been beaten during their arrests in a mass roundup ahead of a banned rally. The French news agency AFP reports that Chadema chairman Freeman Mbowe and his deputy Tundu Lissu, both former presidential candidates, and other senior officials were freed on bail on Tuesday. Their release follows their arrest ahead of Monday's planned youth event in the southwestern city of Mbeya. Media organizations in Senegal have staged a blackout day to protest a government crackdown they say targets them directly and is aimed at curtailing press freedom in the West African country. The Associated Press reports that the development on Tuesday comes as tensions have been rising between media organizations and the government, triggering international concerns over press freedoms in one of Africa's most stable democracies. Separately, Senegal's main media companies have accumulated massive debt over the years, threatening the sector's economic survival. The outlets claim the government has moved to freeze bank accounts belonging to them, allegedly for owing back taxes. Critics of Vice President Kamala Harris have used her gender as a cudgel, saying both subtly and overtly that a woman cannot hold the most powerful job in the free world. Gender scholars say those railing against Harris have also chosen another line of attack, her race. Views Anita Powell reports from the White House.
Vice President Kamala Harris's quest for her nation's highest office has run headlong into a barrage of sexist attacks, hammering her love life, her clothing, and even her distinctive laugh. All classic hallmarks, experts say, of misogyny. Harris seeks to flip this narrative, which has persisted for more than a century since the first time an American woman ran for president. But scholars say Harris faces an additional challenge that she can't escape, her mixed race. Here's former President Donald Trump, the Republican presidential nominee.
She was always of Indian heritage, and she was only promoting Indian heritage. I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black, and now she wants to be known as black. So I don't know, is she Indian or is she black?
This, scholars say, is a textbook case of misogynoir. Nadia Brown is professor of government and the director of the Women and Gender Studies Program at Georgetown University.
Misogynoir is the horrible hybrid between sexism and racism that is specifically lobbed against Black women. And it's rooted in stereotypes about and against Black women, as well as them, these notions that they don't adhere to white heteropatriarchal supremacist norms.
These ad hominem attacks have prompted even some of Harris's harshest Republican critics to try to reel in the narrative. Republican Mike Johnson is Speaker of the House.
This is not personal with regard to Kamala Harris and her ethnicity or her gender. It had nothing to do with this whatsoever.
Scholars say there is a groundswell of support for women sticking to more traditional roles in society, as seen in the burgeoning Instagram-friendly tradwife movement, which sees women's roles as homemakers, mothers, and helpmeets. But some women voters dismiss these gendered attacks as ridiculous. Salinas Nash is a California voter.
That's the sexist people. That's all for men. That's all. They said that even when Miss Clinton was trying to run, they were like, oh, no, she's a woman. What if she have a period? She's going to start a war.
Georgetown University's Brown theorizes that Trump is using personal attacks because he fears meeting Harris face to face on the debate stage. In recent days, Harris and Trump have sparred on social media, accusing each other of dodging a debate planned for September 10th. Trump made the first move, calling instead for a September 4th debate, hosted by his favorite news network. Again, Nadia Brown.
I think that's probably a smart move on Trump's behalf, given that Kamala Harris is a former prosecutor, and what we've seen, everything we've seen about her and her debate performances leads many people to believe that she will mop the floor with Donald Trump.
Since women won the right to vote in 1920, their presence at presidential polls has risen. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
And that's it for this Wednesday, August 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a lovely day.
The Young African Leaders Initiative, or YALI, has brought 500 young people from across Africa to the United States. On the next edition of Our Voices, we will introduce you to some extraordinary young African women from over the past decades to share their experiences in the Washington Fellowship for Young African Leaders program. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900.